The president last night working on your economic recovery, one leg at a time.
The recovery and reinvestment package is not the only thing we have to do. It's one leg of the stool.
Please be seated. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 10th. I'm Todd Zwillick, joined by Catherine Lamper. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Todd.
Well, in this hour, a look at what we can expect from the new administration's new plans for the financial bailout. A look at the president's first primetime news conference through the eyes of a reporter who was there. And what it's like to live in revolutionary Iran, even if you're too young to remember the revolution. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
President Obama mentioned a stool in his press conference last night, but he remains standing for all of the primetime event, and he says the government can't take the recession lying down.
With the private sector so weakened by this recession, the federal government is the only entity left with the resources to jolt our economy back into life.
The bill passed a procedural vote last night, but barely. The plan still faces fierce opposition from many Republicans. Here is Arizona Senator John McCain.
It is increasing spending, increasing the role of government in a draconian and unprecedented fashion, and laying a debt on future generations of Americans of many trillions of dollars.
The plan goes up for a full Senate vote today. If it passes, lawmakers must then merge it with the somewhat different plan passed 2 weeks ago by the House.
The Obama administration is also unveiling its plan for how they'll spend the remaining TARP bailout funds. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is holding a press conference today to discuss that. The distribution of money is expected to be more transparent this time. Millions of dollars in donations are pouring in for victims of 400 wildfires in Australia. The death toll is now over 180. The one Southern police chief, Christine Nixon, says weather worsened the situation.
It is, though, extremely sad that people have lit these fires on the worst day that Victoria could have had. The temperature was so high, the circumstances of the previous weeks, really did cause an environment that many of us were very concerned about.
Police believe that some of the blazes were deliberately set. The American envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan is making his first visit to the region. Richard Holbrooke arrived in Islamabad last night. He says he's planning to listen during the three-day visit.
Israelis are heading out to vote in their general election today. Rain and strong winds expected to keep the turnout low. The Dow closed down a bit yesterday at 82.71. The S&P up a little, closing at 870. How should the stimulus plan money be spent? Does your town need a new hospital, a new industry? Maybe your family needs health insurance.
I'm calling from Massachusetts. This is Beverly. I'd like to see real support of libraries. In economic hard times, libraries are crucial, and to see them cut and put on really tight budgets is a travesty.
All right. Here's the drill for the rest of the hour. Tell us where you live and what you need. Call us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or go to MyTake at thetakeaway.com. We'd like to hear what you would like to see in the stimulus package.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
One of my bottom lines is whether or not credit is flowing to the people who need it. Is it flowing to banks? Is it flowing to businesses, large and small? Is it flowing to consumers? Are they able to operate in ways that translate into jobs and economic growth on Main Street? And the package that we've put together is designed to help do that. And beyond that, I'm going to make sure that Tim gets his moment in the sun tomorrow.
It's Tim's Moment in the Sun. I'm Todd Zwillick, joined by Catherine Lamfer, in for John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. Well, this morning, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner does have his moment in the sun. He'll announce how the second half of the $700 billion TARP program that Congress approved for the bailout for troubled banks will be spent. The Bush administration's implementation of the so-called Troubled Asset Relief Program, that's TARP again, got plenty of criticism. But will the Obama administration do any better? To help us try to answer that question, Lizzie O'Leary, Washington, D.C.-based reporter at Bloomberg News, is on the line. And so is Tom McCool, director of the Center for Economics at the Government Accountability Office. Lizzie, how much do we know right now about what Tim Geithner will announce for the second phase of TARP? This morning, some reports are suggesting that it could reach as much as $1.5 trillion.
It could reach as much as $1.5 trillion, and I think it's important to point out the disconnect between that $350 billion that remains and what Congress appropriated and allocated back in September and approved in January, and then what the overall cost will be. So just because the money doesn't come from something that Congress said, here, go ahead, you can spend this money, doesn't mean it's not there. We're talking about an expansion of a Federal Reserve program that would let investors or help investors basically get cheap loans to buy credit assets that are backed by commercial loans. We're also talking about some sort of program that would leverage private capital to try to buy those really bad assets that we've heard about clogging banks' balance sheets.
All right. Well, the first phase of TARP was criticized for not requiring banks to start lending. There was some suggestive language in the plan, but it certainly wasn't a requirement. Members of Commerce complain about that all the time. Do you think that requirement will be in there explicitly this time?
No, I don't. It won't be for a couple of reasons. You heard the president last night in his press conference say, we want banks to lend, but you didn't hear him say, and we're going to rewrite the law to say they have to. One of the concerns that some of the folks at the Treasury Department have is if they put a lending requirement into law, that some of these banks are in such a precipitous financial state that they just might teeter, and they really might need the capital to actually cushion themselves from more losses that could still be coming from some of these assets.
Okay, so still relying on the bank's discretion to get credit loosened up. Tom McCool from Government Accountability Office, I want to turn to you. The GAO wrote a report critical of the first phase of the TARP, especially regarding transparency. This is a big deal. What differences are you hoping for this time around to get more transparency into this plan?
Well, I think that we're hoping that there will be at least reporting requirements, if not lending requirements, put on any new recipients of TARP funding, especially under either the capital purchase program or whatever they call a new program that injects capital into banks. So at least a reporting requirement in terms of what the banks intend to do with the money and also what they have been doing with the money over time.
Well, one of the questions around reporting requirements is should it be dollar for dollar, you know, total transparency, how much has been spent where, or sort of broad brushstrokes, we're spending some money in this sector, some money in that sector, we've kept some for salaries, we've kept some for capital, some for cushioning. What should that look like? What is transparency in this case?
Well, I think it would be nice if you could account for it dollar for dollar. I'm not sure if that's always going to be feasible. But if you do report lending activity, you should be able to follow what happens when capital moves into a bank and then how the activity changes. And so at least analytically, you could get a sense of what the injections were doing to the lending activity.
Hey, Lizzie, I want to turn back to you again. Let's talk about how the Treasury Department is going to get private investment to help the banks. How exactly is that going to work?
Well, I think that's the $1.5 trillion question. The idea is that the government didn't want to put so much taxpayer money at risk that they would form a bad bank, an aggregator bank. That's an idea that was kicked around. They thought, gee, that just might be too expensive because if the government pays too much for these assets, the taxpayers take a bath. And if they pay too little, then the banks crumble anyway and the taxpayers take a bath. So what they want to do is essentially provide a government guarantee against loss, but an incentive for private investors to do well on the upside if these assets turn around and start performing. And some of them may. I think an economist I heard last week used the example of a house. You might not want to sell your house right now. you can draw the analogy with an asset. But if you hang on to it for a year, you know there's some intrinsic value there. So the hope is if the government says, we'll insure you against loss with this small amount of money that we have now, we want you, private investor, whoever that may be, and frankly, hedge funds are the only people with the money right now, to come in, buy the asset, and eventually we hope you are enticed by the idea of a future profit.
Tom, is there anything to the worry that come from the banks, and I know you've heard this, that too much transparency is actually a disincentive for them to participate, that if people know too much about what they do with the money, that the banks don't necessarily want to be in the light of day and we need them to participate?
Well, that certainly was the Treasury's argument for not asking for reporting requirements to begin with. And I think that there is obviously some reporting burden that you put on these institutions, but they already have to report quarterly on all this type of information to their regulator. And we didn't think that additional reporting, more frequent reporting, would be that burdensome. There may be some cases at the margin where banks would decide not to take the money, but I don't think that, given the limited amount of reporting we're asking for, that would really be the case.
Hey, Tom, I want to make sure I'm clear here. The burden here is just in the act of reporting, not on actually reporting what you spent the money on. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. Reporting your lending activity for a particular period of time.
Right.
I mean, it's rolling up your records and sending off a report to the government, effectively.
And doing that is so burdensome.
Doing that monthly rather than quarterly is
right.
Effectively what we're asking.
Right. Lizzie, is there what chances are there, I should ask, that housing is part of this plan? Now, housing, they say something on foreclosure mitigation, helping people stay in their homes, which was part of the root of this whole thing in the first place. A plan on that is coming later in the week. There are a lot of people in Congress. There's a part of the stimulus package, actually, in the Senate, says that $50 billion of this TARP must be spent on foreclosure mitigation. I don't know if that's going to survive negotiations with the House. I guess the question is, will it survive negotiations with the House, and will it be part of Geithner's plan today?
Possibly, and yes.
Uh-huh.
Or in the future.
In the future, but not necessarily today, though.
Not necessarily today, for a couple of reasons. I think that the administration also made the bargain that they wanted to let the president announce a foreclosure mitigation program. Now, we know that there will be some of that $350 billion allocated to foreclosure prevention because Larry Summers, the head of the National Economic Council, put it in writing to the Senate, basically said, we are going to use between $50 and $100 billion for foreclosure mitigation. It looks like that's going to be closer to $50 than $100, but it also looks like, and we had been getting hints from Treasury at the beginning of the week that they wanted to keep this as a separate program. It looks like it will be a separate program, and that is, again, separate and apart from whatever survives what is sure to be a contentious House-Senate conference on the stimulus package.
Right, and Chris Dodd of the Senate Banking Committee said he wasn't taking anyone's word for it, not even Tim Geithner, not even Larry Summers, not even the president, that foreclosure mitigation was going to be part of this, so he had his amendment passed. Just to make sure everyone was on the same page?
Just in case. I think right now there's a lot of distrust between the different ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, and I think that's one of the reasons, to go back to the first question you asked me, the administration, are trying to make sure that there are other funding streams for what they want to do for the financial sector, because right now I think if they were to turn around and come back to Congress and say, by the way, we need another $1 trillion to prop up the banking sector, there's no way that there would be the kind of appetite among the appropriators to dole out that money.
Okay, lots of twists and turns left in the TARP. Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg News in Washington, D.C., and Tom McCool, Director of the Center for Economics at the Government Accountability Office. Thank you both for joining us.
All right, Todd, there's TARP, and then there's the stimulus. What do you think should be in there?
More money should be spent on mass transit to update our transit system, especially in New York City. I've been to Shanghai, and I've been to London, and their subway and bus systems are significantly better than New York bus systems and subway systems. And I feel like if we have to compete with these two cities, we got to update everything.
That's his idea. What's yours? Tell us where you live and what you need. Call us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, and I'm here with Catherine Lamper. We're both in for John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. Today, we're talking stimulus. How should the stimulus plan's money be spent? Does your town need a new hospital, a new industry? Does your family need health insurance?
Hi, this is Paul in Brooklyn, and what I want from the stimulus package is I want restaurant vouchers. Listen, I live in New York. I really can't afford to eat out very much, and this is a big restaurant town, and I feel like I am not part of the conversation.
Tell us where you live and what you need. Call us at 1-877-8-MYTAKE or email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
As most of the free world knows by now, Todd, Alex Rodriguez saddened legions of fans yesterday with his admission that he used performance-enhancing drugs while playing for the Texas Rangers. But he didn't just sadden the fans.
I think it's depressing news on top of what's been a flurry of depressing items when it comes to Major League Baseball. And if you're a fan of Major League Baseball, I think it tarnishes an entire era to some degree.
The president isn't mad, A-Rod. He's just very, very disappointed. But there are plenty of others ready to pick up on the moral outrage. We're here now with Takeaway Sports contributor Dave Zirin. He's the author of A People's History of Sports in the United States. Hey, Dave.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great. Now, listen, before we even start talking, let's let A-Rod go ahead and say something from yesterday's ESPN interview.
When I arrived in Texas in 2001, I felt an enormous amount of pressure. I felt like I had all the weight of the world on top of me, and I needed to perform, and perform at a high level every day. Back then, it was a different culture. It was very loose. I was young. I was stupid. I was naive.
All right, Dave, young, stupid, naive. How does that work for you as an excuse?
Well, I mean, he's getting a lot of credit for it because at least it's honest, and at least he's not trying to hide behind excuses like saying, well, I was just trying to recover from an injury, or, well, someone just handed it to me and I didn't know what I was taking. And so he's definitely getting points for that. But I do think that it does raise this eternal question when it comes to steroids in baseball about why it is that we punish individuals and individual players and don't look at the way the entire system is set up to really just be like this anabolic conveyor belt where player after player after player is really just taking these drugs in order to keep up with the Joneses at the locker next to them.
It sounds like you were not shocked then that performance-enhancing drugs were used?
Not even a little bit. I mean, first of all, Alex Rodriguez is part of the Grand Texas connection. It seems like a lot of players who are connected with Texas have been at the heart of this scandal over the years. I mean, Jose Canseco, of course, the person who's become kind of the, I guess, Ilya Kazan of this entire thing, you know, naming names left and right. He's like Ilya Kazan on sodium pentothal, just naming names as fast as he can put out books. But also Rafael Palmeiro, a lot of great players who've been through Texas. And, you know, it all starts, I've always thought, with George W. Bush when he was the general partner of Texas. I always thought that would be the best way to impeach Bush, to get him in front of a grand jury and ask him what he knew about
steroids. Okay, Dave, back to baseball.
All right, Dave. Dave, what's wrong with Jose Canseco naming names if it helps clean up the sport? I know everyone was mad at him. I was at those congressional hearings in the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee when he named the names and Mark McGuire was sitting there and Rafael Palmeiro lied to the committee. So what's wrong with it if it's going to once and for all help clean up the sport?
Well, because that's to get back to that question about will it, at the end of the day, help to clean up the sport. I mean, part of the problem is that the sport still has a testing procedure at this point, which isn't really going to do it. And I think the only person who's benefited from Jose Canseco naming all these names really at this point has been Jose Canseco.
Well, the sport didn't have anything before Jose Canseco did this, did it? I mean, now it may have a second-rate testing regime, but it didn't have much of anything before.
Yeah, but the second-rate testing regime, one of the things it's done is it's driven, according to experts, people with the World Anti-Doping Agency, it's driven more research and development towards dummy steroids, towards black market steroids, and towards an entire subculture that's about figuring out a ways to now to beat the test.
Okay, so Dave, then what should happen?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I think it starts with fans. I mean, I think fans need to ask themselves the question, do we really want to know how the sausages are made or not? And if fans are that disgusted with the use of performance-enhancing drugs, then fans need to stay away from the ballpark. And there needs to be that, because that's something that you're not seeing, even with all the scandals. I mean, the actual business of Major League Baseball really has never been better. I mean, you guys are in a city, New York City, that's about to open a $1.3, some even put it up at $1.6 billion stadium, of which Alex Rodriguez is supposed to be kind of the cherry on the sundae of that thing. And so that hasn't changed. What I think needs to change is the fan reaction to it, or we just need to kind of accept that this is entertainment. I mean, it may not be pro wrestling with predetermined outcomes, but at the very least, people want to see dingers.
All right, Dave. Well, speaking of the fans, can we all agree on a brief consensus here that despite asterisks on home runs and Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire, Jose Canseco, A-Rod, can we just all agree that they're cheaters and they'll never be in the Hall of Fame because they're cheaters?
Well, I don't agree with that.
You don't?
Because, sorry, I can't give you full consensus.
Okay.
I might lose the vote.
Okay.
But I think at the end of the day, that whole period of, say, 1995 to 2005 is going to have to be looked back upon as the steroid era. And we're just going to have to judge players relative to their era because, I mean, there's no such thing as a pure era in Major League Baseball.
Okay. That is Takeaway contributor Dave Zirin. He is a People's History of Sports in the United States author, talking to us about yesterday's revelation that New York Yankee Alex Rodriguez used performance-enhancing drugs earlier in his career. And we turn now to Mark Garrison from the newsroom.
Thank you, Catherine. 28 minutes after the hour, President Barack Obama says the economic stimulus plan now before Congress is designed to stop a crisis from becoming a catastrophe. The president stressed the importance of Congress acting quickly to approve the more than $800 billion plan. He intends it to save or create 4 million new jobs. He said all this and more in his first primetime news conference last night. We'll talk to a reporter who was there in just a moment. Investigators blame China's state television broadcaster for a fire that ravaged one of Beijing's most celebrated buildings. They say fireworks the network set off caused the blaze that engulfed the unfinished Mandarin Oriental Hotel, killing a fireman. There were no people in the building at the time of the blaze. Colorado officials say Countrywide Financial has agreed to provide nearly $6 million to borrowers and the state government. This is to settle claims the company put homebuyers in high-cost, high-risk mortgages. About 6,800 borrowers will be able to renegotiate their loans. They could get interest rates as low as 3.5% for 5 years. Countrywide will also give the state $500,000 to expand its foreclosure hotline. Hundreds of volunteers and fishermen use boats and bare hands in an effort to drive stranded dolphins back to sea in the Philippines. At least 200 dolphins flocked to the shallow waters of Manila Bay today.
Wow. Forget swimming with the dolphins.
Help them. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanfer here with Todd Zwillick, and we are both in for John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji. We're talking stimulus. How do you think the money should be spent?
Hello, my name is Tony from Atlanta. I would like the stimulus package to trickle down to the various mass transit systems around the country.
Tell us where you live and what you need. Call us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Todd?
Well, President Obama gave his first primetime press conference last night. He used the chance to push hard for his economic stimulus plan. Most of us were glued to our TV screens, but April Ryan, who's White House correspondent and Washington bureau chief for American Urban Radio Networks, was there. April, I saw you sitting right there in the second row, I think, off to the president's right. So what stood out to you most?
One, that he had a press conference so early in his presidency. Typically, they say presidents don't do the high wire, which is considered the East Room right off the bat. And this president took it on. He took the East Room on in a press conference in the East Room. He talked about his plan. He gave the talking points. Nothing really new. Some are criticizing the fact that they want to understand how states will get monies, the formulation of how states will get monies for things like an increased food stamp benefit, also the unemployment benefits, and also WIC programs. So, you know, the devil is in the details in some of this program still.
Did you get the sense that the president had a clear strategy going into the press conference? I noticed the answer to his first question, the traditional AP question, first,
yes.
Was 8 or 9 minutes long, a sort of a traditional senatorial filibuster. He seemed to kind of veer off into his own agenda. Did you get a sense that he was taking the opportunity to drive his own message home?
Yes, I did, because, one, I got information this weekend that the president's team, quote-unquote, feverishly had been calling groups across the country, trying to sell this package, trying to get people vested in this package. So now it was next for him to use the bully pulpit and talk to the American public. But one thing, instead of using an Oval Office speech, just talking directly, he went with a back and forth questions. So we'll see we'll gauge to see what the American public has to say this morning after they digested and slept on it last night.
All right. So just press conference logistics really quickly. I was President Bush brought in. I don't know if he brought it in, but had this system of having questioners in order pre-written on his list. And he would go down the list and call on them, usually with nicknames or last names, whatever. So other presidents have responded to raised hands in the East Room and just pick people at random. But President Obama seems to be going with the list. What difference does this make to a White House reporter like you?
Well, it's standard fare somewhat. I mean, last evening I was debating, should I raise my hand or shouldn't I? I wanted to raise my hand. I said, well, it looks like he's going through a predetermined list, and I knew he already had a predetermined list. He went through this list with his press secretary, Robert Gibbs. And what I was told was that the press secretary, as in other presidents, sometimes the press secretaries will go back and forth with the president suggesting, look, this is what this person has been talking about in the briefings. You may want to talk to this person about this issue. But last night he had a list formulated by Robert Gibbs. But ultimately the president is the one who makes the final decision if I'm going to call on that person or not. Now the question is, did he go strictly by Robert Gibbs' list, or did he veer off? But, you know, again, as you said, Todd, you know, Jennifer Levin got the first question, AP, the Associated Press. Then Reuters came next.
Right.
So, and he picked on some of the typical people, CNN, NBC,
right.
You know, Bloomberg.
Right.
But then you went to the Huffington Post.
Right, blogger question 13.
Yes, yes.
Right, and 13 questions in total, and But one person left out in particular, April Ryan from American Urban Radio Networks. President Bush used to call on you all the time. He didn't
I don't know about all the time.
Well, a lot though. He didn't call on you last night. So here's your platform. What was your question?
Okay, I had actually. Let me pull my questions over. I had three questions.
Oh, that's realistic.
Yeah.
I was just gonna say, wow, what press conference were you at?
I know one question. What if someone asked that question? Typically, I would try to have five, but I said, okay, let's see. My first question, the unemployment numbers are 7.6% overall, with a breakdown of whites, 6.9%, Hispanics, 9.7%, and blacks or African Americans, 12.6%. Supporters of the stimulus package say they are encouraged, but don't know the details. What specifically in this package will create the 3 to 4 million jobs that will lower these unemployment numbers, particularly for those hardest hit communities? How are you going to lower those numbers in the unemployment lines for the hardest hit communities? That's one question. The second question was on Guantanamo Bay. The Pentagon says 61 Gitmo detainees have returned to battle. Does that change your thinking in shutting it down as quickly as you wished? And the third question was on Afghanistan. You know, there was a question on Afghanistan. You know, he talked, well, a couple questions on that. Ed Henry.
Yeah.
From CNN, got that question, and along with the flag Drake coffin question.
Right.
And that was a very interesting question during that press conference.
And interesting that he chose not to answer it. He kind of kicked that one down the line and said that there was a Pentagon
review.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, April, sure hope you get your questions in later in the administration. I have a feeling you will. And
oh, trust me, I will.
let me just point out, for those who don't know, a fun takeaway fact for listeners who don't know. April Ryan, I believe, is the one who shot with a handy cam video camera or a cell phone, the now famous video of Barney the White House dog biting a reporter from Reuters, right? You shot that.
I sure did.
I knew it.
I sure did. I miss Barney, too. I was walking down the White House Northwest driveway there, and I said, where's Barney? I said, oh, I forgot we have a new administration. It's just been a couple of days, and sometimes old habits die hard.
And maybe a new dog is coming soon. Thanks for joining us, April. April Ryan is White House correspondent and Washington bureau chief for American Urban Radio Networks. And Mark Garrison is here with headlines.
Thank you. It's 21 minutes before the hour, and bad weather is expected to lower turnout in Israel's election today. Recent pre-election polls have shown the party of centrist Foreign Minister Zipi Livni gaining ground on former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Conservative Party. But remember, this is a multiple party system there, so the leading party will have to form a coalition with other parties. That will determine the makeup of the next government, whether it's near the center or more to the right. UBS, one of the earliest and biggest victims of the subprime mortgage crisis, is still under pressure. The Swiss bank's investment banking and wealth management divisions showed continued weakness today. It's announced a quarterly loss and plans to cut more than 1,600 new jobs. For the first time, more cars were sold in China last month than in any other country in the world. The Chinese bought more than 700,000 new vehicles in January, topping U.S. sales. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev says his country set a new post-Soviet record in arms sales last year. He says Russia sold nearly $8.5 billion worth of weapons in 2008. Russia is a close second to the U.S. in global arms sales in recent years. Big customers for Russia are China and India. Also, a new Audubon study out today says more than half of North American bird species are spending the winter about 35 miles farther north than they usually do. They're going back 40 years when they first studied this, and researchers blame climate change.
Mark.
Catherine and Todd.
Mark, thanks.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are out. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Todd Zwillick.
We want you to turn the stimulus into a stimuli. Make the bill help you out. What do you want in the economic stimulus bill that would help you, your family, your city? Okay, I know. Let's start with how you travel.
Hello, my name is Nikki Shaw. I live on Cape Cod, and I have to drive off Cape every day to work because there is nothing on Cape Cod. And I would like to see the stimulus package bring some jobs to the Cape so that people like myself don't have to drive to Boston or 1 hour every day.
Hello, Karen Votava here, calling from Wakefield, Rhode Island. Let's take this opportunity to promote a more sustainable lifestyle for all of us, to get us all out of our cars. Let's build out the East Coast Greenway, a 3,000-mile bike-ped, traffic-free pathway that links all the cities from Maine to Florida.
I would so do that. All right, Todd. How about energy? Can we get an agreement here?
We'll try.
I would like to see the stimulus money spent on renewable energy, something with respect to improving the way that renewable energy credits are allocated across different states. For example, South Carolina has no credits for folks to spend it on their own personal residential photovoltaic installations, whereas Massachusetts speaks to about 55%.
This is Marla Ricciardi from Florida. Take the noose of federal restrictions off the private sector and allow them to start immediately to build the refineries and the nuclear power plants that we need that would create immediate jobs and ongoing jobs to operate the factories after the construction work is done.
All right, renewable energy versus refineries. Well,
I think there's one thing our listeners can agree on: tax cuts.
Hi, Jerry Tucker from Oklahoma City. We're a small business owner, and our tax liabilities, payroll tax, and other taxes are stifling to putting on new employees. Tax breaks would be the best benefit.
Hi, this is Steve from Stillwater, Oklahoma. As far as the stimulus is concerned, I'd like to see a little bit more tax cut action because I'm a recent college graduate, and I'm starting my own graphic design business, and you know, kind of every little bit helps.
Well, what about giving money back to public institutions?
Hi, my name is Lewis. I live in Bayside, Queens. I'd like to see more money go to transportation and education. I feel like, especially with state universities and state institutions, that we need more funds to compete with the private institutions.
All right, James sent us an email. I volunteer at a major museum in NYC. We just went through painful cutbacks in staff, and those cutbacks are happening into museums all over the country. I want to see money included in the stimulus for museums and cultural institutions.
Oh, that's so selfless, but really, it's all about you.
This is Mike in Massachusetts. If you want to stimulate the economy, please pay off my mortgage. It's only about $250,000. I will have so much money in every paycheck to spend on other things.
Yeah, he had an addendum on that. Paint my house. Okay, tell us what you want out of the stimulus bill. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And then go to our website and be our reporter for Shovel Watch. It's a project where we're cataloging where the money is going. Tell us what your town is already getting from the package. You can find out everything you want to know about this at thetakeaway.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting across from Catherine Lamford. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are out. Mark Garrison is in. He's got headlines.
Thank you, Todd. 12 minutes before the hour, President Obama's economic stimulus plan passed a procedural vote in the Senate yesterday. Just three Republicans supported it, Arizona Republican Senator John Kyle not among them.
Anybody that says they know this will work, you can believe one thing. They're not telling you the truth. Nobody knows. But to spend $1 trillion and not know whether it's going to work is very bothersome.
The stimulus bill faces a full Senate vote today. It's expected to pass by a thin margin. Lawmakers must then merge it with the somewhat different plan passed earlier by the House. The president also addressed the situation in Afghanistan last night in a primetime news conference. He said, unlike Iraq, the political system in Afghanistan is not functioning now. He doesn't have a timetable for how long U.S. troops will stay in Afghanistan. Many women take a multivitamin pill as part of their daily routine, but a new study found that food is a better source than pills for the same nutrients. Here's researcher Marion Neuhauser.
If they're using these vitamins exclusively to help prevent cancer or cardiovascular disease or to live longer, then these data suggest that multivitamins don't achieve that purpose.
The 8-year study focused on older women. Similar results, though, have been found in studies with men. Australia expects the death toll from the wildfires there to top 200. Donations have been pouring in for victims. Police believe some of the 400 blazes were deliberately set. They're preparing to release a sketch of at least one arson suspect. Today marks the 30th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. Relations between the U.S. and Iran were severed after it happened. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said today he's ready to hold talks with the U.S. as long as they are held with, quote, mutual respect. Todd.
Mark, thanks. Catherine?
Polls are open today in Israel. As Mark noted, this is an election that only a few weeks ago seemed a decisive win for former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now it's too close to call. The outcome is obviously going to have a huge influence on peace efforts in the region. And to get an idea of what voters are saying, we spoke earlier with Roz Atkins. He's a presenter for the BBC World Services program called World Have Your Say. It's an international call-in news program. And when we spoke, I asked Roz to describe the atmosphere in Tel Aviv today.
Well, I don't mean to underplay this election, but to be honest, you wouldn't really get the impression just walking around Jerusalem and walking around Tel Aviv yesterday that there was an election taking place today. There's a very strange thing going on. The whole of the world is taking a very keen interest in who Israelis vote for because of what happened in Gaza and because, of course, of Israel's broader significance in the Middle East. But the actual Israeli voters, well, I wouldn't say they're all apathetic, but certainly apathy is being keenly discussed here. Polls are saying up to 30-35% of people haven't decided who to vote for, and there are some fears that quite a few of those people may not choose to vote at all.
What could be behind that apathy, given that so much has been going on there?
Well, I think there are a few things going on. There's a strange contradiction in the system of government here. They have proportional representation. It's very simple. There are 120 seats in the Knesset. If you get 61, you form a government. And the flip side of that is that very rarely does one party get those 61 seats. So we always have coalition building. And as a consequence, there are a lot of elections because coalitions fall apart. When Ehud Olmert said he was going to stand down, Zippy Livni, who's also from the Kadima party, tried to form a coalition. She couldn't. So here we are having another election. Israelis have a lot of elections. There's also a tiredness with the conflict with the Palestinians. A lot of people are telling me here that, well, whoever wins, there's going to be no change. This has been going on for decades, and it probably will continue to go on. There's also, I think, it has to be said, a tiredness with the candidates. Zippy Livni's the foreign minister. Ehud Barak, the leader of the Labour Party, has been prime minister before. Mr. Netanyahu was prime minister between 96 and 99. People feel like they know these people, and they're not going to be surprised, which is where we bring in Avigdor Lieberman, the surprise package of this election campaign. His Betenu party is in third in the polls. He's offering a more radical solution to the problems, including changing Israel's borders, so some areas with lots of Israeli Arabs will actually come under Palestinian jurisdiction. It's hugely controversial and reasonably popular. He's now third in the polls.
I was just going to say, and what does the ascent of Lieberman tell us about Israelis turning to the right?
Well, I mean, I think we need to bear in mind that this is a minority of people who will be voting for Mr. Lieberman. But I think what it tells us is two things. One is that people are tired of the situation, tired of the conflict with Palestinians, and tired of the solutions which are being put on the table. He's offering something more radical, and I think people are responding to that. I think there is also a frustration amongst some Jewish Israelis towards Arab Israelis. They hold them partly responsible for what some people do quite explicitly call a threat within. And Mr. Lieberman is, to use a phrase we use in Britain a lot, calling a spade a spade. And that's resonating with some people. I should say we've had plenty of people get in touch with World Have Your Say and call him racist and other things as well. He's dividing Israelis, but he's definitely attracting attention and voters.
Right, because part of Lieberman's platform is referring to Arab Israelis as a fifth column, as traitors, as not loyal to the country and undermining the nation, correct?
Well,
inflammatory.
He would say it's a little bit more nuanced than that. Mm-hmm. He's simply giving Arab Israelis a choice. He's giving all Israelis a choice. He's saying either take an oath of loyalty to Israel as a Jewish state, or we don't want you to be Israelis. No citizenship, you can't vote, you can't stand for office, and we may even change our borders so you're no longer in Israel. He's saying if Arab Israelis are quite prepared to take an oath of allegiance to Israel as a Jewish state, there's no problem at all. So his supporters say this isn't unfair. This is just a reasonable way for what is, after all, a Jewish state to assert its desire for all citizens to be loyal to that idea.
Obviously, security is a big concern here. But talk about the economy. What sort of role does that play in this election as well?
Well, you would think it would play a huge role. Obviously, I remember covering your elections for the BBC, and back in September when Lehman Brothers collapsed, that really turned the election campaign. McCain was in the lead, suddenly Obama took the lead, and we all know what happened from there. To be honest, people just aren't talking about it. This is, if not a one-issue election, then it's getting very close to it. Economy is being talked about. People's jobs are on the line. The economic downturn is, of course, affecting Israelis like it's affecting every other country in the world. But if I was to tell you it's a big election issue, I don't think I'd be telling you the truth. When you go up to people in the street, the thing they talk about is national security, almost at the expense of every other issue.
National security, but there's a smaller issue there, and I want to find out if it's important. Hamas is, of course, mm-hmm. holding a young Israeli soldier, holding him hostage. Is that Israeli soldier a big issue in the campaign or a sideshow?
Well, so it's been a big issue in Israel ever since he has been captured, and every so often there are news stories in the Israeli media about possible negotiations that are taking place. In the papers in the last couple of days, there have been various sourced reports saying that there are negotiations which are getting very close to a deal, which would see many Palestinian, maybe over 150 Palestinian prisoners, including some with very serious convictions, being handed back to the Palestinians in return for this one Israeli soldier. But I do think that people here have been following this story for a long time, and they tend to respond to actual events rather than possible events. And so while there is a keen interest in the well-being of that soldier, I don't think it is a huge issue until we actually get news of a definite deal.
You know, you were in Tel Aviv yesterday talking to a whole group of voters. Is that where you got this overall sense of fatigue that you have been referencing?
No, well, I've been here in Jerusalem for a little longer than I've been in Tel Aviv, and I think you know wherever you go and you find it. And what is, I have to be honest, you know, yes. strange, Catherine and Todd, is that people are hugely passionate. It's not like they don't care about what's going on in their country. I rarely visited a country where people are more engaged with the issues that are affecting their lives here. But somehow they don't see their political system as being the best way to express themselves politically at the moment, which is where that fatigue comes in. So you have a passionate conversation with someone. They tell you what you think. Then you say, who are you going to vote for? Obviously, quite a few people say, I'm going to vote for this person or that. But a decent minority, maybe 3-4 out of every 10 people I've spoken to have said, I just don't know if I'm going to bother. I just don't think it's going to make any difference. I'm voting for the same people, the same issues, the same policies are coming around, and I don't think my life's going to change according to how I vote.
That's Roz Atkins, a presenter for the BBC World Services news program, World Have Your Say, reporting to us from Israel in an interview conducted earlier this morning. Todd?
The stimulus. How should the money be spent? Does your town need a new hospital or a new industry? Does your family need health insurance? Well, Bud from New Jersey called with a lot of ideas. Here are a couple of them.
They're all public works projects. They're not bridges to nowhere. Conversely, they are projects that are old and desperately need replacing. One of them is the Pulaski Skyway, which was obsolete when it was opened in the 1920s. Desperately needs rebuilding. Second is the bridge to Long Beach Island, New Jersey, which is attended by over 100,000 people every weekend during the summer. The bridge is the only way to get on and off the island, to say nothing of the way the electricity gets onto the island.
Tell us where you live and what you need. Call us at 1-877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
I think it starts with fans, and I think fans need to ask themselves the question, do we really want to know how the sausages are made or not? And if fans are that disgusted with the use of performance-enhancing drugs, then fans need to stay away from the ballpark.
That's Takeaway Sports contributor Dave Zirin on the heels of news that Alex Rodriguez was taking performance-enhancing drugs. As we talk more about the stimulus package, we want to enlist your help as reporters to help us dig up more information on individual projects happening around the country. Tell us what you know about where the stimulus money is going in your area. Take part in our project called Shovel Watch. Go to thetakeaway.org to find out more.
I'm Catherine Lanford.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry is back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Both parties are addicted to the past.
There have been a lot of bad habits built up here in Washington, and it's going to take time to break down some of those bad habits.
Old habits die hard.
You're a hard habit to
breaking those bad habits on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 10th. I'm Catherine Lanford. Todd Zwillick joins me here. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away. Hey, good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Catherine.
In this hour, we look at the details of TARP Part 2. We look at both old and new arguments about the New Deal, and we talk to a documentary filmmaker who says that dog breeding has gone to the dogs. This story's coming up. But first, these headlines.
President Obama used his first primetime press conference last night to call for quick passage of his economic stimulus bill. He says government action is imperative.
Doing little or nothing at all will result in even greater deficits, even greater job loss, even greater loss of income, and even greater loss of confidence. Those are deficits that could turn a crisis into a catastrophe, and I refuse to let that happen.
The bill passed a procedural vote in the Senate last night, but just barely. It faces a full Senate vote today. If it does pass, lawmakers must then merge it with the plan passed 2 weeks ago in the House. The TARP bailout plan gets the moment in the spotlight today, too. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is holding a press conference to discuss how the remaining funds will be spent. It's expected to include a provision that will relieve banks of their toxic assets.
President Obama also spoke about foreign policy last night, including his plans for relations with Iran. He's on the lookout to hold diplomatic meetings.
My expectation is in the coming months, we will be looking for openings that can be created where we can start sitting across the table, face-to-face, diplomatic overtures that will allow us to move our policy in a new direction.
The U.S., of course, severed relations with Iran soon after the Iranian Revolution, which is being celebrated 30 years ago. It happened 30 years ago today. At celebrations there, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said he would welcome talks if they were held with mutual respect. Israelis are holding their own vote today in a general election, and one voter, social worker Dor Ben-Zion, says Israel's security is the most important issue to him.
I believe the next prime minister of Israel has got to be strong enough to handle the nuclear threat coming from Iran.
All right. Let's hope bad weather doesn't keep him from the polls, Todd.
Well, the Dow closed down a bit yesterday at 8271. The S&P was up a little, closing at 870. Well, we're asking, how should stimulus plan money be spent? What do you need in your town? Does your town need a new hospital? Does it need new industry? Does your family need health insurance or more bike paths?
My name is Lisa. I'm from Oklahoma, and I would like to see my town get a recycling program going with some of that money, or at least something for these kids to do. And I would love to be Todd Zwillick's intern. Go, go, Todd Zwillick!
Go, go, Todd Zwillick!
Hey, that'll work. All right, Lisa from Oklahoma, you're in. Tell us where you live and what you need. Call us at 8778-MYTAKE or email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Okay, I'm cutting you off. No more pleas for interns. You're done. Done.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Todd Zwillick, joined by Catherine Lamper, in for John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. Well, should banks be required to explain how they spend taxpayer dollars? Well, the answer to that is a little more complicated than you might think. It was the $700 billion question the Bush administration struggled with last fall when it was constructing the TARP. That's the Troubled Asset Relief Program, just in case anyone needs a quick refresher. Today, as we anticipate the reworked version of the TARP, it seems the Obama administration has a whole new set of questions, like how to restore public faith in that very bailout. Well, for more, we're joined by David Barstow, New York Times reporter who's been covering the bailout. Hello and good morning, David.
Hi, good morning.
The Bush Treasury Department said having banks reveal to the public how they spend the public's money would deter participation. That sounds bizarre, but Obama administration officials haven't necessarily backed off of that notion. It's not much of a confidence builder for those of us who believe in sunlight there, is it?
Well, this is going to be an interesting moment today. The Obama administration has spoken a lot about the importance of transparency, both in a broad way in terms of helping people keep an eye on government, but it has also talked about being more transparent in terms of the stimulus and also with the bailout. But today we're going to really find out how far that transparency goes. What we don't know yet is whether or not the Obama administration is going to demand of banks that get TARP money a kind of complete and thorough accounting of what they did with the money, or whether they're going to be content with a lesser form of transparency. In other words, asking banks simply to give a kind of narrative report of how, you know, what did you do with the money? So that could be a bank sending back a two-paragraph letter that says, you know, we used the $20 billion we've got in TARP money to increase lending and help mitigate mortgage foreclosures, and we're using it for a bunch of other purposes. Or will it really be the kind of thorough accounting that will allow us to understand what actually happened to our public dollars?
Yeah, I read that in your piece that the banks might submit a narrative. Made me think of, you know, it was the best of times, or more appropriately, the worst of times for the banks. Like, maybe not that kind of narrative, but so the banks have said in the past that full transparency, being transparent to the public about how they're spending the public's money, might actually cause them to not want to participate. Can you walk us through the logic of that from the bank's perspective and help us reconcile it with the public's right to know?
Well, I know what the Bush administration was worried about was now remember when this was passed. You know, the financial system was kind of in a full meltdown, and the biggest problem that they were confronting was how do we restore some measure of faith and confidence in the financial system? How do we make sure that people don't create sort of bank runs that really get us into deeper trouble? And what they were worried about was if we make the banks tell the public precisely what they're doing with their TARP money, and a bank comes back and says, well, we didn't actually use the TARP money to increase lending, and instead, really, all we did was we hoarded the money because we had to shore up our own balance sheet. Well, that's a kind of indication of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this fear that if the banks somehow are frank with the public about the true state of their balance sheets, then that could, in fact, undermine the very kind of stability that policymakers were trying to restore by passing the TARP. And so you run into this tension that has been in the TARP from the beginning between, on the one hand, trying to stabilize banks and inject more capital in them, and yet at the same time saying to the banks, you need to do a much better job of lending and of helping people avoid foreclosures. And what we've seen so far from the TARP is that while, yes, it is true that the TARP money did seem to have an impact in terms of bringing stability to the financial system, there's no evidence yet that TARP did anything to stem the rising tide of foreclosures, nor is there really much compelling evidence that it's done much to stimulate lending. In fact, a lot of newspapers, including ours, have reported on banks that actually decreased lending after they got TARP money.
Okay, David, just listening to you, I have to say, we've heard this morning from people who say that they don't want any bad banks, right? And you're saying that the banks don't want to be frank. So no frank banks, no bad banks. What are we left with here?
That's a very good question. I think we're going to learn a lot more about this at 11 o'clock when Secretary Geithner tries to lay out the Obama administration's vision of how they're going to use the remaining $350 billion, that's what's left, of TARP money to try to leverage money from both the private sector but also from the Federal Reserve to do a number of things that the first tranche of TARP money did not do. And so it seems as though one of the things they're going to try to do in order to restore some measure of trust is that, I mean, they are making, you know, they certainly are saying and have taken some steps to increase the transparency into the program. So, for example, they posted a bunch of the big agreements online between the government and big banks. And they also passed some restrictions or adopted new restrictions on lobbying for TARP money. And, of course, last week they also put some additional executive compensation limits on recipients of TARP money. But there really remains a huge question of, and I don't know that it's been spelled out yet, and this will be a big challenge, I think, for the Obama administration to try to explain something that seems so incredibly complex and, quite frankly, opaque to the, you know, to the public, despite the enormous sums of money that are at risk.
Well, you said in your piece this morning that in the first half of the TARP, the big parts of it, you said opaque, that big parts of the first half of the TARP remain hidden, opaque to government investigators, journalists like yourself, and everyone else who cares to look. So sort of a Rumsfeldian question here, but do we even know what we don't know about the first half of the TARP? There seem like there are questions we don't even know how to ask or answer because it's hidden.
You know, when you talk to the people who are responsible for overseeing this, that's what strikes you the most, is we don't even know what we don't know. It's quite stunning to hear them say that at this point they have no idea what really happened to the first $350 billion. Nobody seems to know this. And so it makes it very difficult, never mind the question of whether or not anybody has abused the money or stolen the money or squandered the money. More importantly, from a policy point of view, we don't know whether we did the right thing with the money, whether the use of the first $350 billion and the way we spent it actually made a dent on the main issues that we were trying to repair back in October when this thing was passed.
Or if we hadn't done it, things would have been much, much worse. That's one of the arguments that you hear, you know, as much as it appears not to have accomplished what the original goals were, that the cost of doing nothing was potentially much greater, right?
Yes. I mean, I do think that there is fairly general agreement that in passing the TARP bill, what it did do was it did bring a measure of sanity to the financial markets for at least a period of several months. But then, of course, in January, we watched as Bank of America and Citigroup, two banks that had gotten enormous sums of TARP money, began showing signs of weakness again. And so now we're not even sure whether or not that stability we got in the fall is long-lasting or merely temporary.
Well, David, thanks for joining us. David Barstow from The New York Times talking to us about the bailout. We're going to get some new information from Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner later today. He's appearing in just about 2 hours at a press conference.
Meanwhile, we're also following the stimulus package. How do you think the money should be spent? What would help you out the most? Now, listen, this is Edgar from Yelm, Washington. This is going to get you. We need our interest rates drop from 6 and 7% to a helpful 4%. This would cause me to do two things. Stop raiding my retirement and spend more on the needs like repairs to the roof or a new refrigerator. Stimulate me, motivate me, encourage me. I have been unemployed since November of 2007. It's not easy when we see the wife fearing a layoff every Friday.
Well, Catherine Bruce sent us an email too. He says, I live in a small town of 770 people called Essex, New York. This town does not have any businesses that stay open all year. It also does not have a sewer. My wife and I want to open a small cafe in town, and that would serve the community all year. The building was priced right, but we just couldn't afford the cost to pump out the septic tank. What is more important than water or a sewer? Not much to a cafe. Getting
That's
the sewer
right.
will stimulate the economy and growth. We need opportunities. That's what he says.
Okay. Go ahead. Join us. 1-877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Todd Zwillick, and I'm here with Catherine Lamfer. We're both in for John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. We're talking stimulus this morning. How should the stimulus plan's money be spent?
Hello, my name is Vicky Shaw. I live on Cape Cod, and I have to drive off Cape every day to work because there is nothing on Cape Cod. And I would like to see the stimulus package bring some jobs to the Cape so that people like myself don't have to drive to Boston or 1 hour every day.
And cut down on their fuel consumption. Well, tell us where you live and what you need. Call us at 1-877-8-MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Hey, Todd. This week, New York City hosts the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show, what some call the Super Bowl of purebred dogs. But a documentary from our partner at the BBC has raised questions about the risks behind purported extreme dog breeding. Producer Jemima Harrison says that what makes for best in show could be worst for dogs. In fact, her research last month prompted the British Kennel Club to announce major reforms in its breeding standards. And she joins us now from the UK. Jemima, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good morning.
What are the risks that you see in purebred standards?
The risk, our film basically was about the unacceptably high level of deformity and disease in pedigree dogs, and particularly about the damage done by dog shows like Westminster. The chief vet of the RSPCA here, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, referred to dog shows as parades of mutants, a freakish, garish beauty pageant that has nothing to do with health and welfare. So that's what we're talking about here.
I have to stop you for a minute. So you said deformity. So you're saying that the purebred standards actually prompt what you would call a deformity, but that perhaps for them is an item of beauty on the dog?
Exactly that. If you think that all dogs descend from the wolf, that is how God built the dog. And so we have taken the wolf and we have evolved it, often purely to meet our vanity, into the most extraordinary shapes and sizes, from the tiniest Chihuahua to a huge Irish wolfhound. This hasn't done the dog any good at all. And we've often selected for features like very squashed faces that can leave breeds like the pug and the Boston Terrier literally gasping for breath.
Now, could you make a distinction for me between breeding and extreme breeding?
Not really, because I think it is a problem of perception. Dog breeders think that they're doing the right thing and they love their dogs, but they've become so desensitized to the deformity, really, that is at the end of their leash, that they don't recognize it as a problem.
Well, Jemima, can't a lot of these the breeding for physical traits for things like squashed faces or loose skin that we consider cute, or the shape of the foot or the shape of the hindquarters, can't this is all done through selective breeding for cosmetic reasons, but can't cosmetic breeding be paired with breeding for healthier dogs? Isn't there a way to get good looking dogs with the traits that everyone admires without getting things like, dogs that have diabetes or dogs that have terrible hip problems so that they can't walk?
There's two different issues here. One is the physical problems that are caused by selective breeding. The problem is what we, as you pinpointed, what we consider cute. But squashed faces are really not much fun for the dog. A bulldog, if you want to know what it's like to be a bulldog, stick two straws up your nose and try to breathe through it. So you're going to have to change. I think it's possible to have a bulldog, a Pekingese, a pug, a Boston Terrier, but we've got to really change the way that we see the dogs. We've got to breed for a little bit more of a nose so that they can breathe. Most of these squash nose breeds can't mate naturally and they can't give birth naturally either. They fail the sort of basic criteria for survival.
We have been talking mostly in generalities, and I wondered if you wanted to take one breed and sort of go into what your research showed.
Okay. Shall we have a look at the Boston Terrier, an American breed?
There we go.
It's a brachycephalic breed, which means squashed face. It has a number of incredibly serious eye problems. 20% of them have juvenile cataracts that can lead to blindness. 15% of all Boston Terrier pups are born with a cleft lip and palate, and 12% of them die from respiratory failure. The dog is a wreck.
What kind of reforms did you think were needed in Britain?
I think the reform, the two really. One is to rewrite the breed standards so that it gets rid of the exaggerations. Many of these dogs have changed dramatically from the dogs of 50, 60, 70 years ago, and often to their detriment. So what was once a slightly wrinkled breed is now a very wrinkled breed. So that's the main thing, is to rewrite those breed standards. And the other is to change the insane breeding practices that are causing the level of inherited disease in our dogs. Did you know the American Kennel Club will still register the progeny of mother-son matings? There's a lot of inbreeding that goes on for generation after generation after generation, and that causes the build-up of problems in breeds.
I was just going to ask, when you cast an eye over here, what reforms do you see here that you'd like to see enacted?
The same, really, as is happening in the UK. Exactly the rewriting of breed standards, limits on inbreeding, and the to stop the mad rush towards breeding from the latest champion dog. There's a standard poodle that won Best of Breed at Westminster yesterday. That dog was sired by a dog that died 13 years before it was born. So it was produced by artificial insemination, and it has produced, and the sire has had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of puppies. That causes a terrible impact on the gene pool. And if, as quite often happens, these dogs are carrying hidden problems, like Addison's disease in poodles, for instance, that then, before you, in a blink of an eye, is throughout the breed. So something that was quite rare can become incredibly common.
Jemima Harrison, I'd like to thank you for joining us. Jemima Harrison, the producer of Pedigree Dogs Exposed, a new documentary from our partners at the BBC.
God loves a terrier. Yes, he does. God loves a terrier.
Oh, yes, from Best in Show. God loves a terrier. God also loves a good news man. Mark Garrison.
Christopher Guest, mockumentary, just brilliant. It's 29 minutes after the hour. The Obama administration is trying to cope with growing political outrage over the handling of the government's $700 billion financial rescue program. Today, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner will announce tough new standards on banks who have received bailout funds. It's also greatly expanding an effort to free up credit, targeting people struggling with their mortgage, car, and student loans. In Pakistan, leaders are trying to reassure Richard Holbrooke, the new U.S. special envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan. Leaders who met with him today say the country is on top of security issues, especially those related to Islamic militants. Holbrooke has already met Pakistan's prime minister and will visit its president before he leaves Thursday. Australian authorities say evacuation policies need to be reviewed after deadly wildfires. The death toll is expected to rise above 200. And that is the news. Catherine and Todd.
Thank you very much, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lamfer, and I'm here with Todd Zwillick. We're both in for John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. Now we're talking stimulus. How do you think the stimulus plan money should be spent?
My name is Henry Lorraine from Natick, Massachusetts, and I'd like to see the stimulus package fund local and state governments and also not include too many tax cuts because the government needs the funding. We can't start shipping taxes and then expect to pay for education, pay for infrastructure, and do this in the future.
All right. Here is the stimulus drill this morning. Tell us where you live and what you need. Call us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Todd?
Well, Senate Democrats, Catherine, have advanced the $800 billion-plus stimulus bill. It should pass finally today. Even though most of them don't support it, though, Republicans pushed for some of the changes that are in that bill. Now, to get their priorities in, a lot of other things like school construction, food stamps, and health care were cut. So here to discuss the GOP and the bill are the Takeaway's Andrea Bernstein. She's with us, as, along with Susanna Capilouto, who's news director of Georgia Public Radio. Now, Andrea, we've covered the Democrats and their priorities last week, but you found out about how Republicans are operating. Now, how are Republicans operating in this particular stimulus debate?
Well, what's amazing is if you sort of, you know, step back a bit, of course, President Obama put in a very significant portion of tax cuts in the bill in the first place in order to win Republican support. And as a matter of fact, last night at his news conference, he said, well, maybe I shouldn't have. Maybe I should have just let them fought for it. Then Republicans came in and fought for more tax cuts. For example, the $15,000 credit for first-time homebuyers that got into the Senate bill over this weekend at the request and insistence of Senator Isaacson of Georgia. And yet he won't be voting for the bill. And
right.
In fact, if you look at some press releases and floor statements of Republican senators from across the country, they say this is a hugely unfiscally responsible bill. And yet, look at this change that we inserted into the bill. So it's a sort of classic talking out of both sides of their mouths.
Right. Well, there is a loose tradition in the Senate that when members get their amendments accepted, they tend to support the bill because their priorities are in it. Now, they don't stick to it all the time, but there is a loose tradition that happens. Susanna, I want to ask you, Senator Isaacson is from Georgia, uh-huh. down there where you are. He got his $15,000 tax credit, like Andrea said, for home buyers into the bill, but he's still not supporting the bill. Do you have any insight into his logic?
Well, I think his logic goes, I don't know that it's really talking out of two sides of their mouth. I think what the Republicans are trying to do is maybe just test the waters. In terms of Isaacson, you know, he was a realtor for 30 years. So
right.
He had this idea, let's give a tax cut, because apparently something like this was done in the 70s and it worked. So he gets unanimous support. But his office says that he won't vote for the bill, or he's leaning, you know, against it, because they were flooded with calls 9-1 urging him to vote no. And I ask his office, well, do the people tell him what he should do instead, or what they would like to see instead? And they said, no, they just say vote no on it. They're just afraid by the sheer number of the stimulus. And then they said something about some STD funding nobody wants. So it's, you know.
Which isn't in the bill anymore.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. But I think people sort of try to sort of find fault with it, just so they, you know, I guess Republicans have to kind of get used to this field of opposition. You know, how can we be in opposition? They have to be critical.
Right.
That's
well,
their job.
Senator Isaacson got this $15,000 credit included in the Senate bill unanimously. No Democrat stood up,
right.
Was against it. Nobody asked even for a roll call vote. And we should also point out that there's a similar tax credit in the House bill. It's not as big. I think it's $7,500. Is that correct? And it's I think it's $7,500. It might be a little bit different than Isaacson's tax break. So he pushed this. It seemed like he was almost supporting something that nobody, even in this cantankerous debate, really opposed. So he doesn't really have anything to lose.
Right, because he knows, I mean, he doesn't have anything to lose. Now, he still won't support the bill, but his office doesn't think that will hamper any chances of this not, you know, falling out of the bill in the end. Because, you know, it did get bipartisan support. Now, the question is, can he take the credit for it? You know, once it all passes, hey, look at me, I put this $15,000 in, but you voted against it. You know, that's where, I guess, the voters will have to decide at some point.
Right, Andrea, I want to ask you about taking credit for it, even for something that you don't support. There, you have
right.
This might be a classic politician's gambit here, but are there other examples in the stimulus of members from both parties, be they Republicans, supporting getting things into the bill that they back and they support, and then saying, well, not supporting it anyway?
Well, as you know, all the Democrats are supporting it. So it's, you know, they, you know, presumably can take credit of ownership. I mean, one of the differences between the House bill and the Senate bill on the $15,000 tax credit is that the House bill is a whole lot more targeted, so it costs less.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you know, there's this period last week where everybody was introducing amendments. You know, we want to add this, and Senators Feinstein and Senator of California and Murray of Washington wanted to hugely increase the infrastructure spending, and that got defeated on a procedural vote, but still has had a lot of support. So there was this period where everybody was adding on all this stuff, and then at the end of the week, there was this incredible, you know, contraction. We're not going to get the votes. We have to start taking things out. So there was, you know, that was the sort of context in which everyone was like, yes, let's add a $15,000 home buyer credit.
Right.
You know, what happened is the aid to the states is something that economists have been behind. Now, that sounds to the Republicans like, you know, the kind of sort of classic social programs that they're suspicious of. But what a lot of governors, including a lot of Republican governors, are saying is that that will have a stimulative effect, and that if state governments contract quickly, they will not have to, you know, that will create a negative economic multiplier effect. So you have the situation where today Governor Christie of Florida, a Republican,
right, taking the roadshow down there.
He's taking the roadshow down there. He's appearing with a Republican who was a very big factor in McCain's victory in the Republican nomination fight. And governors. Christ, Governor Rell of Connecticut, Governor Schwarzenegger of California, these governors are very much for the stimulus package, and in fact, they're for the very things that have gone out of the bill. So you have this contradiction in the Republican Party. Senator Mel Martinez, you know, presumably free to do anything he wants because he's not running for re-election, says, you know, no, I'm not voting for it because it's too expensive, and the spending is not where I want it to go. There is this sort of level of you know, I think Susanna's right. The Republican Party is feeling out how to be an opposition party.
Right.
And
Desperately, you know, it's interesting, Andrea. It's true. The states desperately, especially even Republican states, need this money. And some Georgia Republicans, Georgia needs $2.2 billion. You know, they're short too. They're not as bad off as New York or you know, other states.
So those Republicans are going to have to decide
the conference report comes out. Exactly. They started out in saying, you know, oh, no, we don't need any money from Washington. We balance our budget. They can't.
I'd like to thank our guests, Susan Capilouto, news director at Georgia Public Radio, and Andrea Bernstein, our Takeaway correspondent. Andrea, by the way, has been working on a special joint project between the Takeaway and the investigative newsroom ProPublica. It's called Shovel Watch. It tracks the spending from the stimulus bill, and you should check it out. Go to shovelwatch.org to find out more.
All right.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are out. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Catherine Lanfer. Today marks the 30th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution, the 1979 overthrow of the U.S.-backed Shah, and the rise to power of the Islamic clerics under the Ayatollah Khomeini. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians are celebrating the anniversary today with a rally in the center of Tehran. And interestingly, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said today that he would welcome talks with the United States on condition that they were held on an equal footing. Iran and the U.S., of course, cut ties in 1979 after the U.S.-backed Shah was overthrown. John Line, a BBC correspondent in Tehran, joins us now for more. John, just yesterday, President Barack Obama said he was open to dialogue. Now we have the president of Iran saying he would welcome talks. How much of this is connected?
Well, certainly they are slowly here warming to the new your new president. The reaction has been extremely cautious. The first comments for the first week or two since the inauguration was, let's wait and see, it's up to America to make the first move. And then last week, President Ahmadinejad responded to the unclenched fist comments of President Obama by saying, yes, we're interested, but then launching a really strong attack against America. And now the fist is just beginning to loosen up a bit, not quite fully unclenched, but certainly a warmer response here from President Ahmadinejad.
What is it like there on the ground today? What's happening?
Well, it's been a big rally. It's an annual rally, actually, on the anniversary of the revolution. This is the day 30 years ago when the Shah's regime just collapsed, really. The military decided they weren't going to fight anymore. The Shah had already left. And that was it. That was the beginning of the Islamic Republic. So today, it's a little bit like the 4th of July, in a way. People come out. You don't have to support the government to come out. You come out for your what is effectively the national day, although the people at the front of the crowd cheering President Ahmadinejad were obviously the real hardliners. There was a kind of party atmosphere, a lot of stands along the stalls along the street on the way into the rally. And then the rally itself, well, most of it, a fairly boring speech, to be honest, from President Ahmadinejad, listing the achievements of the Islamic Republic, tonnages of production of steel and things like that. It could almost have been Stalin's Soviet Union.
All right. Now, I know you did a report for the BBC on the underground music scene in Iran, which is just one reflection of the fact that nearly half of the country's population is under 25, not even born when the revolution happened. So what does that mean for the legacy of the revolution?
That's right. I think my experience of the younger generation here is that they are really, talk of a generation gap, it's an old phrase we used to use, but they're quite disconnected really from politics. They don't even oppose the government or the concept of the Islamic Republic. They're just completely detached from it. It's how does one get around this? How am I going to be allowed to play my pop music? How am I going to be allowed to, just dress normally and enjoy life normally. And so it's not just an underground pop music scene. Kind of normal life really has gone underground. Dating, for example. You try and find somebody on the internet, or you try and message them on your phone. You can't go and meet somebody in a bar or something. So life is going on in a sort of parallel universe from the strange hardline, particularly this hardline Islamic government.
All right, John Lyon, I want to thank you for your report there from Tehran.
My pleasure.
I have to say, John Lyon looked great in an underground recording studio. You have to see this video. John Lyon, BBC correspondent in Tehran, one of our partners.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Catherine Lamfer is here. We're both sitting in for John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji, who are both away. But Mark Garrison is here, and he's got headlines.
Thank you, Todd. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, Wall Street is open for business. The Dow's down just under half a percentage point. Investors will watch what happens next with the president's stimulus package. He says failing to pass it could turn the nation's economic crisis into a catastrophe.
The plan's not perfect. No plan is. I can't tell you for sure that everything in this plan will work exactly as we hope, but I can tell you with complete confidence that a failure to act will only deepen this crisis, as well as the pain felt by millions of Americans.
The bill faces a full Senate vote today. It's predicted to squeak by with just 3 Republican votes. Meanwhile, the Obama administration appears to be backing the Bush administration's arguments when it comes to a lawsuit involving rendition. The case involves 5 men suspected of terrorism. They say they were taken abroad, tortured, and interrogated. They're suing Boeing because they say Boeing provided planes to the CIA for the so-called Extraordinary Rendition Program. Now, Justice Department lawyers tell a federal appeals court that allowing the case to proceed could pose a national security risk. That's the same argument used under the Bush administration. A new Audubon Society study out today says most North American bird species are spending the winter about 35 miles farther north than they did decades ago. Researchers blame climate change. Audubon scientist Greg Butcher says pretty soon birds will run out of north.
If these temperatures continue to warm, these birds will continue to move farther and farther north and may in fact run out of room to continue to move.
Now, we tell all sides of the story here at The Takeaway, so we're balancing birds with marine life. I will also say that hundreds of volunteers and fishermen use boats and bare hands in an effort to drive stranded dolphins back to sea in the Philippines. At least 200 were stranded in Manila Bay. Todd.
Effort to get dolphins back at sea. Mark, thanks for the headlines. Catherine.
Okay, the debate over the economic stimulus bill has invoked old arguments about the New Deal, Todd. Here is Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell talking about the New Deal before the Senate on Sunday.
The big spending programs of the New Deal did not work. In 1940, unemployment was still 15%. What got us out of the doldrums that we were in during the Depression was the beginning of World War II.
And President Obama addressed that last night in his press conference.
In fact, there are several who suggested that FDR was wrong to intervene back in the New Deal. They're fighting battles that I thought were resolved a pretty long time ago.
The president might think they're resolved, but we have plenty of people willing to revisit those arguments. And this morning, we're going to talk to two of them. Amity Schles is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. And Nick Taylor, author of American Made, A Comprehensive History of the WPA. Hey, good morning to both of you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good morning.
I'm going to start with you, Amity. What is the crux of the debate that has been revisited about the New Deal?
Well, the crux has changed. So we had two cruxes. Right now, the crux is about whether when the government spends in Washington, that brings the economy back in a sustained way. And some people think it will, or it's the best tool that we have to spend like crazy in Washington. And other people say, including, I guess, myself, that you get a jolt, you do better for a while, but it's not a sustained recovery. It's more of a populist pattern like in Latin America. One happy year and then sad years that follow because government spending isn't the optimal way to get productivity gains to get strong growth for a longer period.
Nick, what do you see as the arguments that we're revisiting?
Well, I think I'm not revisiting those arguments, by the way. I thought the New Deal was a done deal and a good deal. And in fact, when you look at the WPA, which provided economic stimulus and jobs during the Depression went on longer than it should have, not because of those jobs and that stimulus, but because Roosevelt withdrew the stimulus in 1937, causing a recession in the middle of the Depression.
Somehow I think Amity's going to have a response to that. Amity?
Well, that is the story that we all should look at, 35 to 40. And Nick and I do. I am my forgotten book, my forgotten man book, my non-forgotten book. And
I was just going to say, please, no more self-deprecation.
So we're psyched about that. What I argue in the book and what the economists at the time were saying was that the government was intervening too much, one, by prosecuting, actually, scaring business to death, two, by raising taxes. They had an undistributed profits tax then. And there was a kind of frozen feeling. Corporations weren't investing the data that are relevant there, things like domestic private investment. They weren't investing. They were frozen. And the economy just waited for a time when it could work or be left alone but wouldn't be managed and prosecuted. Another component I want to add was monetary. There was a relative tightening. So that's a factor, too. That comes from the Fed, though, nowadays,
okay. Not
from spending so much.
Amity, we have an actual point of conflict here. If we got Nick to roll his eyes, then you must have said something good. What's going on, Nick?
Well, we look at economics, and economics is a science, just like physics and chemistry. But unlike physics and chemistry, it is a science that deals with human beings. And so while the theorists and the academics are trying to lay out all these grand plans for what the economy should be doing, people are suffering. They were suffering when Roosevelt became the president after 3 years of depression, and he had to do something. First it was relief, then it was jobs. And now we're in the same situation. We stand at the edge of a precipice, and the Republicans are wrapping themselves in the same cloak that they have torn to shreds over the last 8 years, the cloak of fiscal responsibility, just to gather themselves in opposition. And what we need is the jolt that Amity herself talked about to get the economy back on track.
Okay, well, let me jump in here real quick, Nick. The Republicans are saying that the New Deal didn't create jobs and didn't create jobs. I don't know whether or not they say it didn't.
May I address that? Hey. Since I presumably know what the Republicans are saying,
yes,
according to you.
You can in one second. Hang on. You can address it in 1 second. I have a question. Nick, how instructive is the New Deal in terms of this economic stimulus? Is it like the New Deal? We're not creating what's called the alphabet soup. We're not creating a WPA. We're not creating a TVA. We are spending on infrastructure, but we're not creating massive what the president calls make work projects. So is that argument even instructive for what we're doing today for or against?
Well, absolutely, because the jobs that were provided during the New Deal provided stimulus. Keynesian thinking was very new at the time, and what Roosevelt wanted to do, and Harry Hopkins, who headed the WPA, was to provide jobs and the dignity of work, which is a little bit of a paternalistic kind of thinking in today's terms. Nevertheless, that's what it did. And if you look at the infrastructure that the WPA created, It's with us today, 75 years later. It advanced the country. It improved the physical plant, and it helped us prepare for World War II.
Amity, I'm going to let you have the last word here.
The numbers tell the story. If we're talking about suffering, the main thing about the New Deal is that in the later 30s, unemployment was 15 or 20% in some months, and that even the great defenders of the New Deal in that period acknowledged that it was more or less always over 10%. That is the humane number.
It was because Roosevelt withdrew stimulus.
That is a very constructed argument and not accurate, I would say, Nick. It was because Roosevelt ceased to spend. The morning after that we are also going to have, after we spend this, we'll have two great years. It'll be a high, and then there will be a big come down.
So what's wrong with two great years?
What's wrong with two great years? Is the future of the economic growth of the U.S. in the government or is in the private sector? Obama, the new president himself, said it was in the private sector. What this package does is make it more difficult for that private sector to deliver those future jobs.
Okay, I'd like to thank our guests, Amity Schles and Nick Taylor, for joining us. Amity Schles is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Nick Taylor, author of American Made, The Enduring Legacy of the WPA.
We're following how the modern-day stimulus package is going all this week online. How should the plan's money be spent?
Hi, this is Peggy calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Jobs, 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 jobs. We need jobs. I don't have kids. My husband and I don't own a home. We need jobs. My name is Sarah Ballard. I'm calling from Columbia, South Carolina, and the economic stimulus for my family is tied to health care. If we could do something to reduce my monthly premiums for health care, which are over $500 every month, that would free up an enormous amount of money for us to spend on other things, as well as our deductibles and out-of-pocket minimums for major procedures like having a baby, which we're going to be doing this year.
Tell us where you live and what you need by calling 8778-MYTAKE or going to our website, thetakeaway.org. While you're there, tell us where the stimulus money is going in your area. Take part in our project. It's called Shovel Watch. Go to thetakeaway.org to find out more. And here's your takeaway.
Good morning, Takeaway. This is Troy from North Dakota. And I just have to say to the on-air personalities that are at work today, is this the B-team or is it the real A-team? You guys sound fabulous today. Excellent flow to the program and very professional.
Oh, Dad.
I'm Todd Zwillick being very professional.
And I'm Catherine Lanford. John Hockenberry is back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.